much for that. Next up on the agenda is Jeffrey Davidson. So the floor is yours, Jeffrey, please. Thank you very much.
Did you borrow this from my library?
By the way, I'm a McGill graduate as well. That's so that you'll keep the questions humane and tender, right, when they come. When we talk about mineral resource development, this involves the search for identification, evaluation and development of targeted non-renewable deposits of fuel and non-fuel minerals. These concentrated deposits of minerals have fixed locations, are of variable quality and quantity, and pose a variety of extractive challenges that are a function of their physical deposition, their mineralogical and structural characteristics, their geographical locations, and the demand for specific commodities and end-user products of which they are a part. Today, the search for these deposits, or for those types of deposits that can be extracted profitably or economically, has spread globally into areas that are increasingly remote, not easily accessible, with limited infrastructure or governance, in biophysical environments with fragile ecosystems and vulnerable human populations whose survival is often linked materially and spiritually to these places and ecosystems. Whether it's Canada's far north, tropical Amazonia, or the dry, high-altitude plateaus and mountain areas of the Altiplanos of Latin America, and that's just on this side of the planet without talking about the other side, right? Well, these minerals enable us to enjoy our post-industrial ways of life. The search for extraction and sale of these minerals also generate new economic and developmental opportunities for those people under whose land the minerals are found, but also the potential for major disturbances, dislocations, and adverse impacts on the communities and regions that will be affected by extractive activities. Ironically, the very opportunities and risks to host countries and communities posed by their own mineral endowments and the ensuing extractive activities also create the potential for conflict at local, national, and even regional levels. Many of the factors and conditions which singly or in combination can give rise to conflict are well described in your publication. I don't have a copy here to raise up like Louise did, right? During a recent visit to Peru, a country which has become increasingly dependent for its economic survival on the extraction of primary resources, social conflict around resource development, and not just mining, has increased to a point where conflicts now are publicly tracked and reported, and four government ministries, mining and energy, environment, culture, and agriculture, including the Water Authority, each have their own conflict resolution units, with the Prime Minister's office promoting a coordinated approach to reducing the risk of conflict and to resolving conflict when it occurs. Dialogue tables have become a major means for bridging concerns and creating space for agreement making, with formal mediation having a lesser role. but this may even be changing. I'd like to share a few observations. Conflict around oil, gas, and mining activities may be project-specific, but have national governance implications. There are situations, some of which have been highlighted in the guidebook, where the potential for intercommunal or political conflict already exists, and the intrusion of extractive enterprises can serve as the lightning rod that ignites the conflict in full form. So, for example, the Bougainville copper mine in Papua New Guinea and the oil fields of Aceh in Indonesia were not in and of themselves the cause of conflict between the regions and the central government, but the mine and the oil fields introduced a new dimension, an element to a pre-existing conflict and became part of a larger problem. Conflict, the final point, conflict must not be accepted as an intrinsic natural outcome of extractive activity. How prospectors and developers approach, engage, and work with the communities and governments affected by their activities has a lot to do with minimizing conflict risks and contributing to community sustainability. How well communities are prepared to deal with such activities, their potential impacts on their livelihoods and ways of life, and the nature and extent of their prior experience with extractive activities also have something to do with the way the experience unfolds. How prepared and effective local and national governments are to regulate and manage extractive activities to ensure that benefits to both the country and the affected communities are greater than the costs is another issue or aspect. And then there is the role of the international institutions and home governments and what role they can assume to help reduce the risks of conflict, especially in fragile and conflict-prone states. In the case of Canada, this is what the government's extractive sector corporate social responsibility strategy for Canadian companies operating abroad is all about. Defining ways in which the government of Canada can promote responsible business practice and the continuous improvement of social and environmental performance on the ground. In other words, doing business the Canadian way. The strategy also defines ways of intervention, the ways in which the government can intervene appropriately to reduce the risk of conflict, and how the government can proceed and hold Canadian oil, gas, and mining companies accountable when they act irresponsibly. The Office of the Counselor, which is what I'm part of, as a piece of the strategy, had its mandate refocused last November when the government issued an updated version of the strategy. And the Office of the Counselor is no longer to be reactive to situations already spiraling out of control, but to be proactive, to work at the front end of extractive activity, to promote and support responsible policies and practices, to clarify government expectations, and to concentrate on early detection of potential problem situations and intervene early enough and in ways that would diminish the risk of conflict escalation. It is the Government of Canada's belief that early detection and appropriate interventions will serve to, quote, alleviate polarization on issues, avoid unnecessary hostility or emotional damage between the parties, and prevent conflict escalation, to use the language of the guide. Early intervention may be initiated by the office itself or be a response to a request for help from an individual, a community group, or a company itself. This may lead to dialogue facilitation or even mediation if deemed appropriate and if requested by both parties to a dispute. So if I ever get to this point of mediation in a formalized way, there is some good stuff in the guidebook relating to the rigor and discipline that supports an effective mediation process, that highlights those unique aspects of mediating natural resource conflicts and some of the particular challenges that complicate mediation efforts, including asymmetrical power relationships between the actors, the marginalization of already vulnerable groups, a weak or absent government, and the challenge of defining who needs to be at the table and making sure that their voices are heard and their concerns are articulated and taken into account. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey. Before we